Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
The secret shame of our age is that there are more people forced into slavery than at any other time in human history. There are more than 2 million women and children enslaved right now and earning their captors a total of $32 billion a year. Invader is a New Zealand-based team of highly trained investigators passionate about identifying and then, with the support of local law enforcement agencies, closing down human traffickers. Headed up by founder Daniel Walker, a criminal investigator with more than 20 years of law enforcement experience, Invader has successfully prosecuted some of the world's leading figures in this insidious industry. Daniel, thank you for joining us in Open House. Connect for us this unique relationship between Tony Campolo, yourself, and rescuing children from sexual slavery.
As a young man, a new Christian, I suppose, to the church, a teenager at university in New Zealand, I was actually becoming bored, really, with the revolving door of salvation that was presented to me and in the particular church that I was attending, and was starting to ask, really, like, is, you know, so Jesus came, died, suffered, and rose again for this? Is this it? And then I heard Tony Campolo, and he talked about the kingdom. And for me, that changed everything, the kingdom of God, that actually the ultimate aim of man was not church growth and related ministries, but to seek first the kingdom of God and all its beauty and abundant life and passion. And he talked about God's heart for the poor and the oppressed, for justice, that if all we do is worship him and do not do this work of justice, that it is a stench to him. And that I suppose as a young man hungry to know not just about God, because I'd learned a lot about him in my Sunday school years but didn't know him, I wanted to know him. And I read Jeremiah 22:16 says he rescued the poor and the oppressed. Is that not what it means to know me?
How does slavery enter anybody's equation? How do you end up there?
Well, trafficking is essentially two things. It's deception or lies and coercion or force. So that's what makes it particularly insidious, because initially there is some form of deception, and that deception can take many forms. It can be promising a young girl in Myanmar or Cambodia a job in a big city or a neighbouring country where she will be able to earn enough money to support her entire family. And so her belief system about her role as the oldest daughter, and perhaps her religious beliefs, her worldview, even her family's attitude toward her as a woman, all feed into the fact that this is a good thing. This is, yeah, there's a bit of risk, but it's a risk worth taking. And so she goes, only to arrive at the destination and find out that it's a brothel, and a debt is imposed on her. She's raped and brutalized and told that she's not free to leave until she can pay off that debt in full. But in other countries, for example, Australia, United States, it can take the form of a very suave, romantic male befriending a teenage girl who is perhaps looking for affection and for someone to tell her that she's beautiful. And it can take place in our suburban malls where every day men are looking for those girls who are vulnerable, who they can befriend initially as their girlfriend, boyfriend, and then subtly, you know, a few weeks, sometimes months down the track, look, I'm not making enough money. If you were to sell yourself, we would be able to do this, this, and this. And then she discovers that she's just one of several girlfriends of this particular male. But then it's too late, and she's almost... she's in it too deep and suddenly finds out that she can't get out.
We're not just talking now about physical bars. We're talking about mental bars. We're talking about reasons for people not escaping other than a locked door. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yes, it's both and. I mean, I certainly have been in brothels where there's bars on the windows, there's chains on the beds, you know, where it's very clearly they cannot leave. But I've also been in other brothels where the threats and the fear is so, the terror, the absolute terror is so palpable, not just for them, but also for what will happen to their families back home. If they ever talked, if they ever tell anybody what that they are a slave, the traffickers have, in some cases, they'll take 11, 12 women from Eastern Europe, they'll transport them to a brothel in southern Malaysia, they'll take them to the top of a tall building and push one of them off. and then turn to the others and say, you know, we have no qualms at all about doing that to any of you if you ever step out of line. Or even more insidiously, they'll hold up a photograph of their little brother and sister back home and say, you know, you might escape. You might even make it to the embassy, and you might even make it home. But before you do, just know that this is what we will do to your little brother or sister back home.
Let's talk about a rescue, because right now I desperately need to hear that there are stories of victory over these crimes. How does a rescue process work? You're involved in law enforcement. What's a rescue look like from your experience?
Well, that's the amazing thing, and I think the good news is that freedom is entirely achievable and comparatively easy, because you can't sell women and children in sex trafficking without the customer. And once you're inside those places, you get to see the floor plan. You get to see who works there. You get to see who owns the place, where the money is going. In some cases, who are the corrupt officials that are coming in and getting paid off. And then you get to spend one-on-one time with one of the key witnesses in the whole deal, the women and children themselves. And in that moment, you've got to assess which one am I going to choose? Which one doesn't look like they don't want to be there? And that you can do that in a number of ways, lots of telltale signs and so on. But and then in the privacy of the bedroom, making up an excuse as to why you're not going to have sex.
Yeah.
You know, I jokingly say sometimes that I sometimes say I'm from New Zealand and we don't have sex. That's why we're a very small nation. But typically I'd say, you know, look, I've just broken up with my girlfriend. I'm just a lonely man. I just want someone to talk to. Look, I'll still pay you, of course. Just tell me about yourself. You know, where are you from? And when are you going home? And what do you mean you can't go home? And why do you have to pay off this money? And just act like a stupid tourist and just find out. So, you know, what's your real name? And who are the officials that come in and get paid off? And they will talk. They will usually, in fact, in some cases, they will take your hand and they will weep and beg and say, please, don't forget me. Tell somebody I'm here and come back for me.
And yet there's got to be a giant leap between that conversation and walking out of the door never to go back. How does that transition take place?
So once we've got evidence that actually this person is here as a result of trafficking, of some sort of lie or deception, and there is some sort of coercion or force, then it's a crime. There's a crime being committed here, and we've documented it. So then we're in a very powerful position to go to, sometimes not the local authorities, because corruption is a huge, in many countries where this is occurring, corruption is endemic, but to go to trusted authorities and say, here's the evidence, you've got to make it risky for the perpetrators. And currently in the world, less than half of a percent of all victims of human trafficking will ever be rescued. So if that was burglaries, you know, in Australia, everybody's home would be broken into right now, because there's no risk to the perpetrators. So we want to make it more risky. We want to start, as we have done, start seeing people go to jail for 20 years for trafficking 5 and 6 year old girls. And in the process, then start to empower local police. They start to see, actually, this is incredibly easy to do. We're getting really good press as a result of this. I'm getting a promotion because I just locked up some trafficker. So they love it. And then they start giving us or calling upon us for assistance. And we can give them that technical advice, you know, some of the equipment that we use. And it's really just empowering the community, the global community, to work together to fight this in a really effective way.
There's got to be a toll that guys like you pay for this. What's been your personal toll in working and rescuing those indentured into sexual slavery?
Yeah, I did this work for 4 years for two American-based organisations, and I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I was good at it. I got to bring all of my God-felt passion and zeal to this work of abolition and rescue. Had the honour of rescuing several hundred women and children over the first few years. But yeah, insidiously, as you say, it did start to take a toll. And it was a toll that I couldn't really see. But for every victim that we weren't able to rescue, you know, sometimes between leaving the police station in a police station in India, for example, and arriving at the destination, someone made a phone call and we would arrive and the girls weren't there. And so I would get back on a plane and fly home to the US where we lived at the time, not knowing, I didn't know what to do with that. You know, what do you do with the fact that I've just failed to get this little girl out and she's still being raped for profit somewhere, except to become even more determined never to fail again and become all the more intense and focused and start to believe a really toxic lie that it was all up to me. And the world became an incredibly heavy burden to carry. And ultimately, I became very burned out, was suffering from secondary trauma, although I wasn't aware of that at the time. And I was on my very last deployment in Jamaica. I was with a 28, 29-year-old woman from the Ukraine. She had been trafficked some years earlier, but she'd paid off her debt in full and was just making some money for herself. I gave her the usual story. I said, look, you've given me some great information. I don't want sex, just give me a massage. But in the course of that massage, I crossed a line. She was very good at massage. I betrayed my wife. I betrayed my marriage vows, my God, my mission, myself, everything I believed and held dear. And I couldn't believe it had happened. I was completely undone. I discovered in a second that I was not the Superman, that I, the perfect man that I perhaps had insidiously again come to believe, and I was completely shattered. My wife and I moved back to New Zealand. We tried to hold our marriage together and ultimately failed, and sadly today we are divorced. And again, I was completely completely undone by that whole experience. And I went to see a police psychologist during that time, which they send you to when your world falls apart. And he said, look, I suggest you write down your thoughts. It'll be very cathartic. And that's where the book came from, God in a Brothel. It was actually just my way of putting it out there, thinking that I would never go back to this work. But by writing down what I had seen, I could help other people see what I had seen and hear the voices I had heard, in the hope that they might act and share that global responsibility. And it was in promoting the book, actually, in the United States, that a number of people said, look, you know how to do this work well. You also know now how not to do it. That's where Invader came from, was a number of people saying, what if you created an organization that built on your successes but also your failures, both personal and professional, so that you didn't send men out by themselves but as a team, and you had really robust care of staff and good debriefing, good accountability, good supervision. There was a culture of transparency and honesty about what these men were experiencing as they went into bars and brothels, because it is fraught with danger.
Tell me about the role of faith in justice for you when you get on an aeroplane having missed the boat, that you don't get a chance to rescue, or a rescue falls over. You touch on the fallibility of a man, but talk about the fallibility of the spirit when it's been a failure and you find yourself crying out, as you must, where were you in this, God? How is it you let that person be shepherded away in the middle of the night when we were ready to do this for you?
I think your last sentence just touched on how I used to see it. You just said when we were doing this for you, and I think that was where I was flawed. That I was certainly going out, as you say, as this James Bond justice troubadour, doing it for God. Whereas actually my whole understanding now has changed, and I think I am beginning to see that actually that He doesn't actually need us to do this work. He doesn't need us to turn, you know, stone into bread. He doesn't need us to set people free, but He so loves us that He invites us to share in this amazing adventure, this amazing passion, this amazing joy, which does include sorrow for a broken world, but also includes incredible excitement and joy, and to participate in that. And I think for me that's absolutely essential, because the moment you start to think that this is our role and we're doing it for God, and that we're somehow alone and isolated, rather than this is something that He's already doing, and He delights in sharing that joy and that adventure with us, then it completely changes your approach to the work. And so to answer your question, when there is failure, you know, from our point of view, I suppose it's coming back to that and saying, God, you know, we know your heart breaks far more than ours does for this woman or child that we were unsuccessful in rescuing. We leave that with you. I mean, you are her father. We don't know where she is now. Perhaps she's been moved or relocated, and that really is where the faith comes in. Faith enough to still go home and play with your kids, and to still go home and smell the flowers, and to notice the sunset, and to eat, to notice the taste of food, but also to be authentically honest and to scream at him in that primal kind of, you know, some of my most intimate moments with him have been when I've gone to the beach and I have sworn my head off and I've told him what I thought of him. And at the time it felt somehow, well, it's definitely a very un-Christian thing to do, but looking back, they were the most amazing times of intimacy because there was absolutely nothing between me and him. It was raw relationship. And in hindsight, I think some of the most precious moments when he said, you know, that's what I crave more than anything is doing this with you because that's why I made you.
Share with us some stories of triumph here, those that you met, you touched, and you left with, whose lives have been changed, and how they have seen recovery and peace and a response possibly to faith even.
Sure. Well, I can tell you about going into a village in Southeast Asia where we had been told there were very young children being sold every day. And I followed the pimp through a series of alleyways to a house that was being used as a brothel. Two 14, 15-year-old girls were brought in. And again, I was covertly recording the whole thing. And the pimp told me what they were good at, how long I could have, how much they would cost. I said, you know, actually, I'm looking for something a little bit different and I'm going to go elsewhere. And at that point, he said, no, wait. I know what you are looking for. He left the room and he came back in a few moments later with two 6-year-old girls. And they had pigtails in their hair and teddy bears on their shirts. And again, he said, for $30, you can have these girls for 1 hour. I said, fantastic, you know, because as a cop, I'm looking at that through the eyes of an investigator.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, this is fantastic evidence. This guy has just committed a crime that I have just documented on camera. He is screwed. And I'm hoping that the evidence I've just gathered is going to set these girls free. So I said, have you got any more girls like this? And he said, absolutely. And over the next 3 weeks, he introduced me to nearly 50 children between 5 and 12 years old who were being sold every day to men from the US, from Europe, from New Zealand, and from Australia. And we arranged for this big sex party. I said, I've got these clients that are coming in. And on the prearranged day, they brought these kids to this location. The bus with my clients pulled into the village. But much to the horror of the pimps, 80 armed police officers got off this bus, acting on the information that I had gathered and rescued many of those children. The youngest child I carried out of a brothel that day was 5 years old. And 10 pimps were arrested and ultimately sentenced, some of them to up to 20 years imprisonment. And it was a groundbreaking case in a country where up until then, this kind of crime just wasn't on the radar of the authorities because there was too much money being made from it. But that 5-year-old girl has recently just got married to a pastor, and they recently just had their own child. But I could tell you many stories of women and children who are now leading really productive lives. Some of them have gone on to be social workers, lawyers, advocates themselves because they want to use their experience and either prevent others from going into that life themselves or just to help the world become aware that this is such a huge issue.
We started this conversation, Daniel, linking intrinsically justice with faith. How do we stop another 4-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 19-year-old, any life being sold into slavery, right here in this city, right now?
Just tell somebody. Tell one other person what you've heard today. And find out about it. You know, don't be blind to what is going on behind closed doors, because ignorance is what they rely on to traffic these women and children. So becoming educated, becoming aware, you know, I would promote shamelessly God in a Brothel, you know, read the book, not because it's a bestseller or any book about this issue. And then look at what is in your hand. You know, there will be people listening who have skills. Maybe they have someone in their own faith community or extended network who have skills as an investigator, a lawyer, a social worker, a business person. It'll be husbands choosing to love their wives and daughters well, to teach them that they are of value, and that any man who promises anything different is someone they shouldn't trust. And then I think the most exciting thing for me is the third part of what our organisation does, which is empower the church. Because there is one organisation on earth that has been commissioned to set people free, that is in every community pretty much around the world, and that is that has the skills to do something about it. And so if the church, the global church, started to communicate with each other and share information in a way that the criminal groups are doing quite openly, because they're making $32 billion annually out of it, if the church, you know, we recently rescued some women who'd been trafficked from Kenya and Uganda to China and then to Bangkok, Thailand, and that's where we met them. We, you know, we're a small organization. We don't have contacts in all those countries, but through the church, we could contact the necessary ministries so that when those women were sent home, they had someone there waiting for them who was able to care for them and help them in their restoration. And that's the church being the church.
Daniel Walker, thank you so much for your time and your honesty. I know this hasn't been an easy conversation at times, and we've been blessed by you joining us at Open House.
Thank you.